And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. Lynn Ware Peak is, as we say, off on assignment, but she will be returning for next week's program. We're trying to minimize the amount of people that are in here at the studio, so we're kind of doing these little staggered shift type things, but we still want to, of course, bring Cool Science Radio to you on a weekly basis. And last week, we had a pandemic expert on, and we also had the medical editor from Scientific American, and it's really good to be able to communicate this information to you about the virus, but also I have a little bit of what I would call COVID-19 fatigue, so I'm very interested and very happy that we're able to present these two interviews to you this morning that have really nothing to do with the virus, but it's just more about, you know, really interesting science stuff. And of course, our last guest was a taped interview we did with Ann Dreehan on the Cosmos Possible World series that we interviewed her, I think it was 3 weeks ago, put it on tape because we were under construction. At that time, we had to tape early in the morning before the workers came in. So that's why you're probably hearing more tape conversations. And our next guest for you is Gemma Tarlak. She's the senior editor of Discover magazine. Gemma discusses the most important science stories of 2019 and their potential impact into the future. The name of her issue is The Science That Matters 2020, hit newsstands in early January when we interviewed her. So this is a best of that we have prepared for you. And it's kind of the top 50 stories, and we talk about only several of them, DNA tests, CBD, spaceflight, gene therapy, and more. So we're going to play that interview for you now. Here's Gemma Tarlak.
Thank you so much for inviting me. 2019 was an amazing year for science, so I'm thrilled to talk about it with you.
It really was, and there's so much to talk about. We should jump right into it. It's kind of no secret that I have an affinity for Pluto. So we found out
don't
that
we
Pluto,
all?
Oh my God, I love that. I love that. I was going to say planet, dwarf planet, whatever you want to call it. But
you know, between you and me, you can call it a planet. You're among friends.
Oh, thank you.
That makes him feel better. We talked to Neil deGrasse Tyson and about Pluto, and you know, he's just said, John, you got to get over it, this thing about Pluto. But
I'm getting over it.
You know, in science, like in everything else, everybody's got their something. You know, don't ask me whether dinosaurs had feathers because I will fight you on that.
Yeah. But before we talk about Ultima Thule, I just wanted to mention this. In April 2018, we interviewed Alan Stern, who was the mission leader for the New Horizons spacecraft that did the Pluto flyby. And then, of course, was pointed in the direction a couple billion miles away and went to Ultima Thule. And when he was on the program, this again is April 2018, I asked Alan, I said, Alan, when is it going to intercept Thule? And he said, well, it will be on December 31st at such and such a time. And I wrote it down.
Yep.
And I mean, there's some heavy math that goes into that. He was spot on. He nailed that thing. It's incredible that they did that.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, the degree and detail of calculations that they do for all the missions, it just boggles the mind. You know, I'm sure you and I probably use math mostly to balance our checkbooks and maybe do those kinds of tasks. But the amount of certainty that has to be rock solid, no pun intended, when it comes to these planets and such. But it just boggles the mind. And so, yes, they can tell you with certainty decades out where specific, not only specific projects in the sky will be, but obviously near-Earth objects and planets and other things in the Kuiper Belt that are billions of miles away from us. They nail it, if not to the second, then often to the minute and hour.
Yeah, it's incredible. So number 8 of your 50 was Ultima Thule. What do you think of that flat pancake?
Well, I have some news. I have some news, and I hope you are not really in love with the name, because in November, after our magazine went to the printer, they actually changed the name. So it's now the object formerly known as Ultima Thule. I hope that you're okay with that. It's now actually, it's called Arrokoth, and that is a Powhatan word, a Native American language from the Mid-Atlantic seaboard, and the word means sky. So in November, they decided to change the name, so it's now Arrokoth. So that said, it is super exciting. We've got this object. It's actually kind of two objects squished together, and it's again 4 billion miles from Earth in the frozen distant area that's called the Kuiper Belt. It is just, you know, the furthest distant object that humanity has gotten a close-up look at. So it's huge. It's very important. And one of the things I love, the information that New Horizons was collecting, it traveled back to Earth at light speed, and it still took 6 hours to get from the New Horizons craft back to Earth. So that gives you a sense of the distance. Traveling at light speed, it still took 6 hours.
Mm. Wow, that's a story. And Ultima Thule was a really cool name, but I could never remember it, so I'm okay with Arakoff. That works.
and I love, you know, I love that Arakoff both, you know, it has a very strong historical connotation, but it also, to me, it sounds like, you know, a planet they'd land on in the Star Wars galaxy, you know? It sounds, yeah, I could see, you know, Tatooine and Hoth and Arakoff. So I love the name.
Yes. Okay, so not to hop around, but we're going to hop around because we have so many great stories. I am particularly interested in the second story on kind of an update to what CRISPR technology, where it is right now, and actually in clinical trials for treatment for cancer. Tell us all about that.
Yeah. Well, this was a huge year for CRISPR. You know, obviously at the end of 2018, CRISPR made very big news for the Chinese scientist who had used it to edit embryos, human embryos. And that, I want to be clear that is a completely different use of CRISPR. There are completely different ethical concerns about it. And so what happened this year is much more the most promising and really mainstream and hopeful look at CRISPR. And that is really, they are, you know, they've done their lab studies, et cetera, and now they're trying this technology in humans who have not only a couple different forms of cancer, but also sickle cell anemia and a really terrible disease. We know it as bubble boy disease. It's technically X-linked severe combined immunodeficiency, but they're making great strides, not just in cancer, but a number of treatments. And basically, CRISPR, the easiest way to describe it is a pair of scissors that goes in, snips the DNA, and then is able to insert a new gene that works. And that's the great thing about CRISPR. There are side effects. There are potential very negative consequences, but researchers are getting better and better at refining it and making it more precise.
And so while researchers are working on that and the rest of the world is considering the ethical issues behind gene editing, are we getting to a place where it's becoming more black and white instead of sort of gray? Like, what is the morality here and how do we broach this scientifically?
Well, I think one of the things to keep in mind is that the changes, for example, that Professor Hay made in 2018 on the human embryos, those are changes that the little girls that were born with these gene-edited, the edited DNA, those are changes that they conceivably will pass down to their children and their grandchildren. And that is a huge concern because the technique is not refined. We don't know all the consequences. We can't control it with extreme precision. Yes, it's a precise tool, but it is not extremely precise. And it does have potential off-target effects. And what that means is sometimes when you go in and change a little piece of DNA, another piece of DNA that you didn't want to change changes. So there are a lot of things we still don't know about CRISPR, and that's why there's a lot of concern about making changes in parts of the DNA that will get then passed down to generations. So what they're doing now with the cancer clinical trials, the stem cell, and other diseases that they're focusing on, those changes are just for the individual. They are in parts of the DNA done in a way that they will not be passed down to future generations. And that's a key distinction. It's also a much more highly targeted approach to what they're trying to do. And so those are, in the sense that I think CRISPR will always be a gray area, but there are some areas that are more black and white where you can say, yeah, it does appear ethical to try this very precise, very limited treatment to potentially cure a truly devastating disease. So I think that's a big distinction.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Gemma Tarlac. She's the senior editor of Discover magazine. We're talking about the Science That Matters 2020. It's an issue that just hit the newsstands. It covers the top 50 stories in science of this last year that was great next year, last year, and also may have an impact in this next year. Gemma, before we let CRISPR go, I just wanted to mention that I hung out with Dr. George Church for a couple of days in La Jolla in October. Mm-hmm. His team is credited with discovering CRISPR, and the fascinating thing to me is that it's only been around for 6 years, but people have only really been using it for the last 4 years. So it's just a tremendous upside potential, and it's just very exciting.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because there were a couple different labs working on CRISPR a decade ago, mm-hmm. developing it. So it's actually I don't want to get into the whole controversy, but it's a little bit of a thorny question to talk about who gets to be called the father or mother of CRISPR.
Yeah. But I'd like to go to quantum supremacy because we did a story on it this year, and we've been following quantum computers and talking to people about it. You highlighted it as number 16 on your 50. Let's talk about it.
Sure. And, you know, I think quantum supremacy sounds like, you know, a James Bond movie title or something. But for folks who don't know, quantum supremacy is, it's basically the point at which quantum computers can outperform our very best classical supercomputers and in solving a specific problem. And quantum computing itself, you know, a lot of readers ask me, like, what is this thing? The easiest and fastest way to explain quantum computing is to think of your computer at home, your phone, etc. It's basically binary. It's a classical computer. So binary means every little bit of it that is working to solve a problem, to get a result, is either on or off. It's either a one or a zero. Quantum computers have qubits instead of bits, and those qubits can be simultaneously on and off. So that's kind of a nutshell for folks who aren't familiar with quantum computing. That's what gives them this ridiculously super fast processing speed. And, you know, in October, you may have mentioned this in your story, Google announced that it had achieved quantum supremacy because they said it took its quantum processor only 200 seconds to complete a problem that on the very best supercomputer would have taken 10,000 years. So that sounds really impressive, but I do have to say there are a lot of companies trying to achieve quantum supremacy, and as soon as Google said that, other companies came out and said, well, actually, it would have only taken 2.5 days on a really good supercomputer. So there's still a question of whether quantum supremacy has been achieved, but it's clearly the direction that computing is going.
It was fascinating because they inadvertently put it up on the web. They took it down very quickly, but not before everybody read it. And we reported the next morning, and we just got a kick out of it. But it's a very exciting technology that, who knows when that will be available.
Probably faster than researchers were predicting even a decade ago. I mean, our writer spoke with one of them who basically said, you know, I thought this would be happening in 50 to 80 years. I didn't think it would be happening this year. And he is someone who's spent his entire career immersed in this. So it's happening, and dare I say it's happening at a quantum speed.
Well, all this talk of quantum supremacy is making my head spin. It makes me want to have some CBDs to...
No, don't do it.
That was a bad segue, wasn't it? But
it's okay.
I've heard worse.
So as you say, or as it said in Discover this month, no single compound expanded its market in 2019 quite like CBD did. And of course, we all know that. I mean, you show up at the grocery store and, you know, on the end cap, there is CBD, this, that, or the other, which really gives rise to that question about, you know, what's real, what's not, what's been approved, what hasn't. And so far, only one CBD product is FDA approved. And what does that all mean?
You know what? Well, I have some personal theories. I think one of the reasons CBD has taken off the way it is, and it's really easy to market, and it's really easy to, it's kind of a shorthand. You know, CBD, it sounds really cool, and it also sounds kind of science-y. You know, it's not one of these woo-woo things, but when you say CBD, it sounds like, yeah, that's solid, that's tested. And no, it's not solid, it's not tested. It has a lot of potential, but the marketing and the consumer interest in CBD far outweighs what researchers can actually say through rigorous robust studies. So that's something to be, you know, very much aware of. We're not saying it doesn't work, but we just don't have the data. And, you know, the FDA approved, the single drug they have approved, it treats seizures from very rare types of epilepsy. And there is good, rigorous data supporting that. So, yes, of course, the FDA is going to approve it. But for everything else, like, you know, my vet tried to get me to buy CBD-laced rawhides for my dog. I'm like, no. No. So, yeah, it's... basically, it may work in a few different ways on a few different issues. It may even be a potential antibiotic, but we just don't have the data to say, yes, it does this in the brain, et cetera. One other thing that I think is really, really super important for your listeners to understand, researchers don't know how the body processes and eliminates CBD. And that is really important because they don't know how it's broken down in the body. They don't know how it interacts with other drugs. And you know, a lot of people, whether they have chronic pain or anxiety or other issues that CBD has been touted as helping, they may be on other medication, and we just don't know yet how it may interact with CBD. I think that's a really, really important point.
That is an important point. And it makes me think, I mean, I've been using CBD for sleep, and wow, does it's wonderful for sleep. And yet I would not probably buy some of these products that I see in the grocery store or, you know, in little gift stores and things like that. I would be more likely, and I don't know if this is a proven way of, you know, purchasing, but when I go to those states where marijuana is legal and you go into the dispensaries, it seems like they've got some kind of pure or at least more informed. I don't know. What's your thought on my theory?
I have some bad news for you, Lynn. You know, all these gummies and oils and, you know, creams and whatnots, they're not regulated by the FDA. And, you know, I can't say, yes, the dispensaries are probably a better source, or no, they're, you know, no better than your local drugstore, et cetera. There's just no regulation. It's very much the Wild West, and it's very much, you know, folks aware that they can make a lot of money very quickly. And in those kind of scenarios, you have to ask yourself, is product purity always in the top of the minds of the folks selling them? I think not. So I'm really looking forward to more rigorous science and getting more companies to put products forward that are truly backed by scientific data. And until then, I'm just going to remain neutral and just say, well, we'll see.
One of our favorite stories that is in this issue was also written by you. The rock-eating shipworm shocker.
Yes.
We have to talk about that. And you said rock on or rock out. So that's one of the things that I appreciate about the story. But it's a fascinating story. So let's talk about this strange animal.
Yeah, so this is crazy. And you probably think, well, a lot of people listening probably think shipworm, that's a clam. What do I care about a clam? But this is so crazy. It would be like finding a population of humans that ate only car parts. It's nuts, okay? That's why when I saw this study come out, I called the researchers up and I said, talk to me. This is just bananas. So a little bit of background. Shipworms are indeed a kind of clam. There are a bunch of species around the world. And the reason they're colloquially known as shipworms is because they have been a scourge of the maritime industry and sailors around the world for millennia. And that's because shipworms generally eat wood. I mean, every shipworm we know, except for this guy that I'm about to talk about, they just gnaw on wood. So they're eating, you know, they're aquatic clams. They're eating through docks. They're eating through piers. They're eating through boat hulls, which is really bad if you're the one on the boat. And, you know, they cause all these massive problems. So this team went down to the Abaton River in the Philippines, and they found shipworms that eat rock. And, you know, the researcher was telling me about breaking open this rock with a hammer and chisel and seeing this shipworm, this clam, going right through it, like, just eating the rock. And again, it's like finding a population of humans that eats nothing but car parts. Just evolutionarily speaking, it's bizarre. It's crazy. And they have evolved all these specific attributes, like their denticles. They don't have teeth, really, but they have teeth-like or parts of their anatomy. They are completely different from every other shipworm. So it's absolutely unexpected and fascinating.
And they range in size from less than an inch to more than a foot.
Yeah, it's a big clam. And it's, you know, they're not the most attractive animal, I will say. They're, you know, they're never going to be like in one of those animal calendars of cute animals every month. Yeah, they're never going to be there. But, you know, scientifically, it's really, first of all, it's really cool, and it's really crazy and unexpected, which makes it interesting. But it also has a larger potential consequence because, you know, as shipworms burrow through whatever they're burrowing through, which we thought was only wood, they leave behind this sticky substance that over time hardens. And in the fossil record, paleontologists find a lot of these sticky tunnels that have hardened, and they always assumed, well, that was a shipworm that was burrowing through a piece of wood. And now we know that's not necessarily the case. It may be a case where the shipworm was going through rock, and for whatever reason, the rock around it disintegrated and just left behind this tube. So they can't use these sticky burrow tubes anymore as to say it's evidence that there was wood in that environment. And that, you know, has potential scientific consequences much larger than the shipworms themselves.
I can see, Gemma, how much fun you had writing that article.
Absolutely.
You're just kind of giddy about the shipworm.
She needs to come out of her shell.
It's my favorite story of the year.
She's very shy. We need to get her to come out of her shell.
Hey, before we let you go, and we have just a couple minutes left, but I wanted to ask you about, it's a small article, but our last guest, Kelly McGonigal, who talks about the joy of movement and exercise and sort of helping with depression, she also mentions ketamine. And there is mention in this issue of Discover Magazine talking about ketamine as a new treatment. I pull it up, you know, just Google it in Utah, and there's actually a ketamine clinic down in the Salt Lake Valley I had no idea of. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yeah, sure. Super quick. So the FDA approved back in March a new drug that is a derivative, basically, of ketamine. It's not just full-on ketamine, but basically that's how it works in the body. And, you know, ketamine has been used for a long time as an anesthetic and has had other applications. But now they're finding that it may have, you know, some people call it a miracle drug. It may have tremendous and immediate effects on severe depression. There are caveats, though, with that. There's some questions about the data used in the approval process, and it doesn't work for everyone, unfortunately. So this nasal spray that got approved, very promising. It suggests that people with severe depression could theoretically, if the drug works for that individual, be relieved of their symptom within hours, which is fantastic. But there are concerns about its side effects. So it's this drug that's been around for a long time, this chemical compound, and now it's finally been approved. I believe it's been 30 years since the last major depression treatment was approved. So this is a big news, but it does come with some caveats.
Yeah, it's so interesting that it has transformed or evolved enough that 30 years later it's something. And I think I remember, I mean, when I remember ketamine as being some kind of recreationally used drug that people were like, whoa, yeah, don't take ketamine. That's really scary.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it originated in the 60s, and it was first used as kind of a quick and dirty anesthetic in really traumatic situations like battlefields. And then, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it was all of a sudden, yeah, Special K, man. And I say that based on what I've heard, not personal experience. But yeah, it was this kind of infamous drug, especially when rave culture was kind of at its height. And so it has a lot of negative I think, connotations. But, you know, it has been a legitimate drug with legitimate uses for a while. And it was in the course of those legitimate uses that they realized it seemed to have an effect on people with severe depression. So that's why they went and developed this one specific type or you know, derivative of it. It's basically half the molecule that makes up ketamine. That's kind of the half the compound that makes up ketamine. So, you know, again, super promising, very exciting, but it's not the miracle drug that I think some of the reporting has presented it to be.
Gemma Tarlak is senior editor of Discover magazine. She was with us in August when we spoke about the science of gun violence in their special September-October cover story from Discover. And I urge everyone to take a look at the podcast if you have not, if you were not you know, if you did not hear that conversation. And she's with us today. The Science That Matters 2020 just hit the newsstands, the top 50 stories in science. So thank you so much for joining us, Gemma. We love having you on.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, okay. Gemma.
And again, that was Gemma Tarlak. That was taped on the 10th of January in 2020. And back to the science of gun violence. On that particular interview that we did, it is not a political conversation. It's on the science of gun violence, and it was such a good issue because I learned so much more about this issue because, you know, I've heard a lot about the political sides, all the different sides, and you keep hearing the same arguments and thing, but this is something new. So you can go to kpcw.org and you can look under shows and you can, under the search key, search on the science of gun violence if you'd like to hear that conversation. We'll be right back after this underwriter.
KPCW shows are now available for podcast. Either through your iTunes or Google Play apps, just search KPCW and download your favorite public affairs show so you can listen whenever and wherever you want. From the local news to mountain money, from this green earth to the mountain life, Cool Science Radio, The Morning Mix, and Cada Domingo. KPCW Podcasts, just another way you can listen like a local.